Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Erica Weitz, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
It's part two of a two-part interview with Chef Mark Forgione on Chef's Story.
You're listening to Chef Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Mark Forgione. And Mark, you're still in your 20s when you come back, mid-20s maybe, 25? Okay, and you've just had, with Laurent Tourandel, your own father, Larry Forgione, American place, graduated UMass in hospitality and tourism, and spent a year in France at a three-star Michelin restaurant with Michel Girard. So, did you say, I'm ready to do my own when you came back?
Well, I came back and Laurent was opening BLT Fish, which again, at the time, this is only the second BLT. This was back when, in a way, before the empire that it is now. So, and he also told me that he just signed a lease on what was to become BLT Prime, and he asked me to help open Fish and then be the chef of BLT Prime. And to be honest, I wasn't sure if I was ready, but he told me that he thought I was, so who was I to argue with him? yeah, I think I was 26, and I was the chef de cuisine of BLT Prime.
Was that on 57th?
No, 22nd and Park.
22nd
Park. And so here I was, like I said, a 26-year-old kid, and I was in charge of, you know, whatever it was, 25 cooks and, you know, huge front of the house. I mean, it was like 75 employees there. And, you know, to be honest, it was very overwhelming, but as with anything, you know, up until that point in my life, I just said, you know, screw it, let's do it. And really just invested every waking moment into it. Looking back, it was a very crazy time in my life. But we got it done. We got great reviews. You know, the accolades that we all wanted and this, that, the other thing. And then I became the corporate chef for BLT.
And how did you like doing that?
For the first... No, for the first 6 months... Well, that was the funny thing. Like, I used to get in trouble for, you know, Laurent would be like, where are you? And I'd be like, I'm at BLT Fish. You know, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm making the fish special for the day. Like, I need you to, you know, go check the numbers. And like, you know what I mean? Like, if I got in trouble for anything, it was for
cooking.
But it was also a cool experience. I opened, I don't even remember how many now. I don't know, 8 BLTs by the time I left. After we opened BLT Market, that was when I said to myself, BLT Market was the kind of restaurant that I wanted to have. You know, extremely seasonal, working with different farmers and purveyors and animal farmers. And so I think when we opened BLT Market, that was when the spark kind of got lit that said, okay, I can't do this corporate thing anymore. I want to go do my own thing. And then I met my now business partner, Chris Blumlow, and...
How did you meet him?
Through a friend of mine from college. He went to UMass as well. We kind of knew each other, but we weren't really like friends at school. We kind of, he was 2 years ahead of me, I think, and like we were in the same circles.
But he was at the business end.
Yeah.
And the two of you have a drink and say, let's go for it.
Yeah, we would meet three times a week down, and he was working the financial center at the time, and we would meet there at 9 o'clock in the morning three times a week. And you know, this is when, okay, pen to paper, and you know, what are we going to do? Here's some menu samples, you know, candlelight, brick, like, what are we looking for in a space, and how many seats, and then
how
I got
to get your investors.
I'll get to that.
All right.
So, a friend of a friend says, hey, I heard you're looking for your own place. There's this place down in Tribeca. And I know it sounds weird, you know, being from New York, but I'd never really been to Tribeca. You know, I was like, where? You know, West Broadway and Reed. Like, what the hell? You know what I mean? So I get on the two or three, whatever. Get out, and I'm like a tourist. I mean, I'm like looking at streets. Like, hey, where's Reed Street? And it was September-ish. Yeah, it was early September, and you know, it's just a beautiful day, and you know, Reed Street's a tree-lined street, and you know, I'm walking up the block. And I see this, you know, beautiful deck with like tables on it, and this tree in the front of this thing. And I'm like, you know, please tell me this is the space that I'm going to look at. And I'm a big like believer in energy and karma and all that kind of stuff. Like the second I stepped up onto that deck, it was like a rush of like, you know, this is like, I just got goosebumps thinking about it. Like, you know, this is it. This is home.
Restaurants have a tree outside.
No, I don't.
Forestry background.
Yeah, exactly. Full circle, right?
Full circle.
But anyway, so we sit on that deck, and you know, we're having a glass of wine, and the guy who owned the place at the time kind of gets up and walks away to go check something, and I kicked the guy, the friend of a friend who brought me there, under the table, and just said, "Look, man, you know, let's just make this happen." Like. Yeah, it's the first place I looked at, which is pretty crazy. I mean, literally the first place that I looked at.
Love at first sight.
Yeah, and so I get my business partner. I'm like, hey, I think I found the spot. Can't believe this is happening. Blah 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 blah. So then the next part of it was the owner saying that he needed a down payment of $375,000 in 3 weeks. I said, no problem, handshake. And then I call Blumlow and tell him, hey, man, good news. You know, I think we got the spot. Quote, unquote, bad news. We need to get $350,000 in 3 weeks. And we had zero money. I mean, nothing.
So what was the kitchen?
We didn't even start talking to an investor yet.
My God. So was the kitchen?
No, the kitchen was a disaster.
A disaster.
The place was a disaster.
Okay. So that was key money, as we call key money,
yes.
Turning over the lease.
Yeah. The place was, it looks nothing like what it looks like now.
Right.
But I saw it, like I knew it. Like there was, you know, he had, you know, subway tile covering brick, and there were mirrors covering this beautiful elevator shaft, and like I saw it. It's hard to explain, but I saw it before it happened. Anyway, so to raise money, we said okay, and we, you know, wrote emails and made phone calls to all of our friends and family and said, okay, we're opening a restaurant. It's $20,000 for a point. You know, who's coming with me? And it turned into, okay, I'm in. Maybe I have a friend. Okay, they want you to go cook at their apartment. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, well,
3 weeks you had to do that?
Yeah. If we're going to go cook at somebody's apartment, you know, why don't we invite like five other people? And I'd go to somebody's apartment and cook, you know, three or four courses for 10 people. And
collect checks.
They would write a check if they liked it or not.
Right.
And
right.
We raised $1 million in probably in 2 months.
What a great story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recommend for anybody else to do it that way because it was as stressful as you could possibly imagine. You know, we were still taking investment 6 months into being open. I mean,
right.
You know, we'd get $20,000, we'd spend the $20,000. We'd get the $30,000, we'd spend the
$30,000. Right. Because you had to redo the kitchen, redo the...
Yeah, it cost us total $1 million to open it. But looking back, we needed $1.5 million. You know what I mean? So I couldn't necessarily get the china that I wanted. I couldn't necessarily, you know, have the payroll that I wanted. You know what I mean? We did it, you know, crazy.
The way you had to do it.
Obviously, it looks like it was the right idea, but if I could do it over again, we would have done it a lot differently. It was nuts. And, you know, the...
What year did you open?
2009.
2008. Oh, great year.
Awesome.
Wall awesome. Street implodes.
So, yeah, we opened summer 2008.
September.
And then September, no, September, October, November 2008, I mean, it just went, just dropped.
And you're by Wall Street. Oh, so for everybody out there, you know, this is a national
program. Oh, no, yeah, no, it was our front porch. I mean, we went from doing 120 covers to doing 20 covers from 1 week to the next. I mean,
how did you...
You know, you went. You we went survive? From doing. We went from doing 85,000 a week, to 35,000 1 week to the next. I mean, if you look at the books from that time, so we had to let pretty much everybody that worked there go. It was me and two cooks and a dishwasher. You know, it was, you know, Blumlow, my manager Matt, and you know maybe four or five waiters. I mean, it was nuts. It was crazy. And we had to do everything. And, you know, going back to, like, when I said, like, France was the year that kind of turned me into a man, well, you know, 2009 was the year that, you know, brought me to my knees and made me... It showed me what being humble was really all about and how important $1 is. You know, I came from, you know, BLT and Michel Girard and American Place and, you know what I mean, places where...
They had the luxury.
Yeah, exactly. And now all of a sudden it's like...
How do you make payroll?
How do I buy meat? I mean, how do I... You know what I mean? How do I, you know, get the fish in? You know what I mean? I mean, it was insane. And I had some purveyors that understood and they believed me. And I told them, look, I know I have a $20,000 credit with you guys right now. And I'm sorry, but, you know, please just deliver the striped bass. Like, please, you know? And everybody at that year told me... you need to change the menu, you need to lower the prices, you know, let's just turn into a bistro. And I just said, I can't do it, you know what I mean?
So you have one business partner and all these investors.
Yeah.
What's your business partner saying to you?
Everybody, not just him, my father included, wanted to turn the place into a bistro. You know, let's do steak frites, yeah, affordable stuff and blah, 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 blah. And I couldn't do it, you know what I mean? I said, you know what, guys, I'd rather close... then try to be a bistro and then go down that way. You know what I mean? Like, if we're going to close, then I'm going to go down fighting and believing in what I do. I worked my whole life to do this. I'm not going to, you know what I mean, start serving, you know, grilled chicken salad. And nothing wrong with grilled chicken salad. It's just...
No,
it's
it wasn't
not,
where you were at.
Right.
It wasn't the way you wanted to.
Right. So, you know, I continue to do what I want to do, and I'm trying with every possible inch of my body, and, you know, finally, okay, we can't do this anymore. And, you know, Danny Abrams from The Mermaid Inn?
Yeah.
He lives in the neighborhood, and he obviously could tell we were struggling, and he basically said, look, you know, I'll buy this from you. You know, I would love to turn this into a Mermaid Inn. I think it'd be great, blah, blah, blah. And we didn't have any choice. I mean... We were hemorrhaging money, and it was just getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. So I make a deal with Danny Abrams. Okay, we're going to give you the restaurant. It's yours. Really depressing day in my life. And I go to sleep that night. It sounds like a fairy tale, but I'm supposed to have a meeting with Danny on Wednesday to close and give him my restaurant. And this is Sunday night. I'm going to sleep. I wake up Monday morning. And I have a message from, what was the guy's name back then? Michelin guide? Anyway, I can't remember. It's in the book. I can't remember his name. But it's a voicemail telling me that I got a Michelin star.
Really?
Literally a voicemail. And I'm like, there's no way I just found out via voicemail, you know what I mean, at 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday.
Jean-Michel.
All right, yeah. So, you know, I call Laurent. I'm like, are you messing with me? Like, what's going on?
He's a French accent. Yeah, yeah,
you know, because I was looking to him for advice on what to do with my struggling restaurant. So I thought maybe he was just messing with me because, you know, Laurent.
Yeah.
I know it sounds like a sick joke, but whatever. I could not believe this. You know. So I checked the online. You know, lo and behold, there it is. I mean, Marc Forgione, Michelin star, and I was like,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yes. Not to paint an ugly picture, but I'm like dancing in the living room in my underwear, like, and you know, I called Danny Abrams and I said, look, man, I mean, I know this doesn't put money in my pocket, but, you know, I'm going to give this another couple months. I got to see what happens now. You know what I mean?
Right.
That this kind of changes everything. You know what I mean?
Right.
I can't get a Michelin star and sell my restaurant. Like,
right.
You know what I mean? But I got to figure out how to do this. And don't get me wrong. It wasn't like the Michelin star, all of a sudden, the doors started to fly
open. What did it do, like, the next night in business?
It added, give or take, I don't know, maybe 10% to, you know, 15%. But it gave us that little...
Make
nudge. Yeah. Well, no, we're still losing money, but we're losing less money.
Okay. All right.
And then the big break really happened. So that happened. And then, you know, then I got some press, like, you know, because at my age, you know, and I wasn't the youngest American to ever get a star. I was the youngest chef owner. You know, there were chefs who didn't own their restaurant that I got one that were younger than me, but... you know as well as I do, to be the chef owner is a lot different than being the chef. You know
yes.
what I mean?
Yes.
So.
Takes it to a whole nother level.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, I was, I think, 29 when that happened. So it was a big deal. So I got some really good press about that and yada, yada, yada. So, but the big break in, like, change in the restaurant was we had an incident in the kitchen where I was yelling... pretty loud, and you know, somebody talked back to me and whatever. I mean, it was just a kind of a bad scene. I mean, you know, chefs get mad sometimes. It's not Disneyland. And you know, as I'm yelling at one of the guys in the kitchen, a customer comes into the kitchen, because it's not an open kitchen, but it's an open doorway, and he tells me to shut up, you know, like I'm trying to eat, shut up. And it was just like, what, you know, what the hell just happened? You know, he leaves, and like all my cooks are looking at me like, and there was a moment that I kid you not, it was like, you know, I kind of closed my eyes, and like it was like looking at a path, you know what I mean? And at the end of that path, there was left and there was right. And you know, right was just stay in here and don't worry about it, and you know, whatever, finish out the night service. And then left was go outside and talk to this guy and find out why, you know, he felt like it was okay to be so disrespectful like that. And I said, screw it, I'm going out there to find out what happened. You know, long story long, I end up throwing him out of the restaurant because of something else he said at the table when I went to the table. And...
what did he say? You can say...
I basically went out there and said, hey, look, you know, I actually apologize. I'm sorry for yelling, you know, you guys don't need to hear that, but the only reason I'm yelling is because I'm trying to make sure everything comes out to you perfect. And he, like, waves his hand in my face, and he's like, yeah, we're not interested, you know, like, get back in the kitchen kind of thing. So I said, all right, it's time for you guys to go, blah, blah, blah. This was on a Saturday night.
Was it all men, or was
it... No, it was two couples.
Two couples. What age were these people?
I would say mid-30s. And anyway, that was Saturday night. And then Monday, I get a call. The hostess comes back in the kitchen and says, you know, hey, the New York Times is on the phone. And I was like, oh, that's weird. And at the time, we hadn't gotten our review yet, which is another part of our first year struggles. For whatever reason, we didn't get reviewed by the New York Times. And I'm going through that now with American Cut. It's very strange. But anyway, so I was like, oh, you know, I guess the New York Times is calling a fact check, you know. So anyway, I'm like, yeah, you know, how are you? This is Mark. And he's like, hey, you know, my name's Ron Lieber. I'm a writer for the New York Times. I was like, okay, you know, how can I help you? He's like, well, I'm actually the guy you kicked out on Saturday
night.
No. And I think he thought I was going to, like, you know, drop to my knees and apologize. You know what I mean? And I just said, okay, you know, how can I help you? What do you want? You know? And he's like, you know, do you feel, now that you've had some time to think about it, what you did was right? And I was like, look, man, I didn't throw you out because you came into my kitchen and told me shut up, which most people would have. I kicked you out because of how disrespectful you were when I came out to the table, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so we got into this, and he's kind of pseudo-interviewing me because he's going to write an article about getting kicked out of the restaurant. And he misquotes me and paints this whole, you could find it if you want, for shits and giggles online. You know, he makes me out to be a tyrant and a maniac, and it's the same as watching a child beat the watching a parent beat their child in the park and not say anything. And it turns into like this phenomenon online, and there's like, I don't know, there's thousands of replies within like an hour of this thing being online. But it was press.
Right.
You know what I mean? Michelin star chef, Mark Forgione, down in Tribeca. You know, and
how did that help business?
I'm not joking. From the day the article came out, the next day we did 50 more covers. You know what I mean? And it was just people coming down there. Because I think what happened was people read the article and they're like, oh, Mark Forgione? Oh, you know, Michelin starred restaurant? Oh, like I didn't even know.
Yeah.
You know, this was as...
Who looks at the Michelin book?
It was kind of after... It was still during the recession, but people were spending a little more at this point. You know what I mean? And, you know, all of a sudden the restaurant got busy. And it actually kind of helped us because I don't think we were ready to be busy when we first opened. But now we were kind of an older restaurant. So now it was almost like a reopening. Literally almost like a reopening. And so that happened. You know, the place is doing well. And then I get the call from the Food Network. You know, I'm not a big fan of TV, believe it or not. I mean, I know I'm on it. But, you know, I've always said the only show that I ever really liked or would do or would entertain doing was The Next Iron Chef. Like, I got asked to do every other show you can imagine, and I said no. And I always said to people around me, you know, I would love to be on The Next Iron Chef. And I get a call from the Food Network, and it's The Next Iron Chef, you know, casting director or whatever. And, you know, long story long, I get on The Next Iron Chef. Didn't think I had a chance in winning, you know what I mean? I was, you know, up against some pretty amazing chefs, Marco Canora, and, you know, and Ming Tsai, and, you know, people that, you know, I knew and I looked up to and was like, you know, wow, this is crazy. And then, give or take, like, by the fourth or fifth week, you know, all of a sudden there was like five or six of us left, and I kind of looked around and said, you know, I think I can actually do this. You know, what helped me win was the fact that I kind of cooked with like a reckless abandon because I didn't think I had a chance of winning in the first place. So I wasn't nervous about making a mistake. I was like, yeah, man, this is like free time, dude. I'm on here. Like, I'm going to try this. You know what I mean? And it really opened up a portal of like creativity in my brain that has never really shut down. It like really opened something in my creative process.
Really? So you had never been that creative before because...
No, something exploded. It really did. It was like... I mean, I think it was because you're... You know, when are we as chefs ever really forced to come up with three dishes in a half an hour using this? Go. You know what I mean? It's like, that's not how you work. Like, you know, you come into work, you analyze what you're going to work with, you think about a dish, blah, blah, blah. Like, this was just like... And I think it really snapped something in my head.
Did that help business when you were on?
Well, and obviously I won, but we had to keep that a secret for 6 months.
Right.
I won in July, and it didn't air until, the final didn't air until November. So, you know, we had August, September, October, and that was 4 months. So it started airing in October. And coincidentally, we finally got our New York Times review the Wednesday of the same week that The Next Iron Chef premiered. It was October 5th or something like that. And it was like the best review you could have possibly imagined. I mean, it got 2 stars, but it read like a 4-star review. I mean, it was like, again, you can find it online. It was just, I mean, it's my favorite restaurant in New York, blah, 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 blah. The food's better than it needs to be. I mean, it was just like, it couldn't have been any better. So that week, with that premiering, we retained our star that week as well. We got the New York Times review. I got Star Chef's Rising Star Chef that Tuesday. All this happened in the same week, and there was something else that happened too. I can't remember exactly what it is. But we look at that week as like the springboard, and my life and the restaurant's life has never been the same since that week.
So now you have a few restaurants. Why? Yeah.
Well, I only had Forge for, you know, 4 years before I even entertained doing something else.
Right.
And, you know, a very simple answer, why? I mean, people don't realize this, but I don't make any money off Forge.
Yeah, I know. Daniel Patterson out at Qua. I said to him, why are you opening these bistros? He says, I have to pay for my kids' school.
No,
I'm not making
it's
any money.
It's the God's
money,
honest truth. You know? I don't make any money from Forge. I really don't.
Yeah.
I'm not even the highest paid person that works there.
You're really? Wow. No, I know.
So,
it's very...
You know, the other places were... and not just for money. I don't want to say it's just for money. Obviously with my BLT background, and you know, I love steakhouses, and I wanted to create a different type of steakhouse, and I think that's what we've done in American Cut. It's really combining a fine dining restaurant with a steakhouse.
Mm-hmm. Where exactly is the New York one?
Greenwich, 363 Greenwich. So
Can
I wanted
you walk
to do that.
From
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Keo. You know, Pet, he's the chef there. You know, we've been friends for 15 years, and, you know, he's been my sous chef on and off two or three different times, and he's an amazing person, amazing chef. And we have always wanted to open something. He was just never ready. And, you know, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, you know, he kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said, I'm ready.
Is he Laotian?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's why it's a Laotian restaurant.
Yes. I'm merely... support for him. It's his food. It's his, you know, it's his dream. You know
right.
what I mean? And there's not a lot of people that I would put my name on something like that. And Pet is one of those few people.
You know, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand for 3 years. And we used to go up to Laos because the French had Laos. Mm-hmm. Thailand was British. So mm-hmm. you could get a bottle of Algerian wine for a dollar, go to the Café de la Paix. This was during the Vietnam War, so it wasn't, right. you know, the Peace Café in those days. But Laotian is a dialect of Thai.
Mm-hmm.
And the greatest saying in the world, I think, is a Laotian saying. And in Thai, there's a word called sabai. And sabai means everything is perfect,
mm-hmm.
just like one of those... perfect moments. We don't even have an equivalent in
right.
English. And so the phrase is sabai ba, sa du ba lai, and it means I'm so sabai. It's like I'm sitting here with my thumb in my belly button.
And if you ever met Pet's mother, that makes perfect sense to me.
Perfect sense. Well, I've got to go because I love Laotian people.
Oh, yeah, no, you'd love it. And it's as authentic as you'll find in New York City.
And where is that exactly?
That's in Tribeca also. It's on Duane Street.
Duane Street. Oh, I'm there. Go there. So, what's your day like now? It's nice you're sitting here talking to me. I'm really, really enjoying this.
You know, it's funny. I've made it a point to make sure that I still remember my roots and remember those humble days of doing 10 covers a night. And you know, not a day goes by where I'm working that I don't get in the kitchen. You know, whether it's working service or coming up with new dishes, I'm still very, very, very hands-on with everything. I mean, just today, for example, before I came here. You know, we changed two dishes going on the menu tonight at Forge. And there's three new dishes going on to American Cut tomorrow, which I'll be at Forge tonight and then American Cut tomorrow to make sure that the dishes go on the way that I want
them. So how often are you in the kitchen?
5 days a week. So, and like I said, I do it because I want to, not because I have to. I have plenty of employees. You know, I do it because it's what I like to do. It's what I love to do.
Do you have... dreams of, like, in 5 years I'd like to be doing X, Y, or Z? Do you still have
Absolutely.
Mountains to climb?
What are they? I mean, I have an idea of what I want to turn, you know, Mark Forgione into eventually, which hopefully, you know, if the cards fall in my favor, I'll be able to do. I can't really talk about it, but I definitely have ideas of what I would like to do. I mean, I'd like to really go for it at one point and, like, you know, go for, like, the two or three Michelin and, you know, 50, 60 covers a night and, you know, the really do the elegant thing that I think as I get older, I'm getting more attracted to. You know what I mean? You know, if you go to eat at Forge, it's, you know, it's beautiful and it's rock and roll and it's fun and it's exciting. And But I think I'd like to have a little more elegance as I start to get older.
Where do you get inspiration now?
Everywhere. I get inspired by everything. It's scary, actually. Last night, for example, I was doing an event at the River Cafe with my cousin and my sister. And when my sister was like, "Oh, how was New Orleans?" I was like, "Oh, New Orleans was fun, you know, blah, blah, blah. We actually did a crab boil, a crawfish boil, blah, blah, blah." And like, as I was telling her the story, I go, "How come people don't boil lobsters in the same manner that you do the crawfish when you suck the head out and get all the spices from it?" And like, my sister was like, "Hello?" I was like, "Sorry." I was like, and I looked at my sister, I was like, "That's how it happens for me. Like, I get inspired by anything. I'll walk by, like, McDonald's, you know what I mean? And I might smell something and I'll come into the kitchen and say, "Hey man, I want to try, you know what I mean, putting raw onions on the burger before we cook it. I walked by McDonald's today and it smelled like something," or, you know, eating at other restaurants, or, you know, reading other books.
So we're going to have to
it's a disease.
It being a chef.
It's, well, just the whole not being able to turn it off. You know what I mean? Like, it's not necessarily a bad disease, but it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week thing that, you know, sometimes when I'm a little tired, I kind of say to myself, I wish I could turn it off every once in a while, but it hasn't happened yet.
We're going to have to close. In fact, this has been so great, I've let it go way over, and it's going to be a two-part interview.
All right.
So, what words of wisdom do you have for an aspiring young chef, someone who's starting out, someone who's in school?
I tell every young kid when they start to make sure that you love this business, you love food, you love cooking, you love the way the kitchen is hot and you're sweaty. Make sure you love that. Make sure that you love having to wake up when you don't feel like waking up and coming to work. Make sure that you love, you know, peeling potatoes. I mean, if you don't love everything that this job is about, you're going to be a miserable, tired, cranky,
lousy cook. Well, on that word note, thank you so much. This has really been inspiring. You're one hell of a chef.
Thank you. We'll hope to see you at the restaurant.
Okay. Oh, you will. You will. All of them. Thanks. Shout out to Robin Cohen and Jack Inslee, my producers, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.